This is the Citizen of Heaven podcast number 217, The Good Future. I'm Hal Hammonds, Citizen of Heaven, your embedded correspondent in Satan's world. Thanks for listening, rating, and subscribing. I'm an optimist by nature. When I talk about the future, sometimes I forget that. This episode helped remind me, for which I am grateful. This week we will cover the glorious future of the persecuted church and when and how it might arrive, the future of church growth and why we are running from it, a guarantee of a brighter future from a voice that Elvis Presley envied, and an opportunity to boldly go where no one has gone before and to glorify God in the process. We'll start with what I've been preaching. Revelation 3:14-22 reads, "And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the first and the last, who was dead and has come to life, says this, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison, so that you will be tested, and you will have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death." This letter doesn't start with good news, does it? The church in Smyrna appears to have been going through difficult times, perhaps more so than the other churches in Asia. It's generally argued that economic pressure was being brought to bear, compelling Christians to give at least lip service to the worship of the emperor so that they might have access to the marketplace. As a result, it seems the Smyrna Christians were suffering mightily. The message of the false prophet in Revelation 13 speaks directly to their situation. There's always the temptation in Jesus to try to have your cake and eat it too. Serve Jesus in your heart while giving shallow lip service to the beast. The false prophet looks a lot like the Lamb of God in a shallow sort of way, but any real inspection reveals the difference. There is no such thing as pretending to serve the beast. There's only pretending to serve Jesus. Can you imagine the brethren listening to this letter being read for the first time, and the crushing disappointment when they hear from Jesus Christ himself that their problems were likely going to get even worse? In the Bible, 10 is the number of strength. The more zeros, the more power. Being tested for 10 days may not seem like much from a safe distance, but think about the last time you were sick for 10 days. Or imagine being forcibly separated from your family for 10 days, or going without food for 10 days. 10 days can seem like an eternity when you are the one being tormented. In such situations, be faithful until or unto death could easily be taken as an assurance that Jesus would not come to their rescue at all, and perhaps for some of them he didn't. But Jesus has never been about securing our present. He has always been about securing our future. Later in chapter 14, verse 13, John records, "And I heard a voice from heaven saying, Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, so that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them." At various times, Bible characters have despaired of life, saying, in the moment at least, death would be preferable to continuing in their current circumstances. Jonah makes such a proclamation, ironically just weeks after being supernaturally saved from certain death. Jonah was likely exaggerating. I fail to believe he would have preferred to go back inside the fish than sit on a hill outside of Nineveh with no shade. In any case, heaven's promise to the faithful in Revelation is not simply a matter of release from current hardships. Their deeds follow with them. The faithful find an actual blessing in death. If Jesus is in us completely, we will be found to be completely in him. And in that moment, the trials of this life will fade into nothingness. As Paul writes in Romans 8:18, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us." And later in verse 25, "But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we wait eagerly for it." James tells us our trials should work patience in us. Paul tells us how dealing with his thorn in the flesh increased his dependence on Jesus in times of trial. Such lessons can make our lives more manageable while we wait to meet our Savior. But even if our suffering accomplished nothing but bringing that meeting closer, that would be enough for us to praise Jesus in the moment and pray Maranatha that much more fervently. This is what I've been reading. When I first heard the story of Charles Colson, I was beyond skeptical. Richard Nixon's hatchet man finding Jesus just before he goes to prison? Tell me another one. And of course, God will be the judge of our motives. But 40 years of service in prison ministry and other religious causes certainly gives me cause to think perhaps I judged Mr. Colson too quickly and too harshly. I read his book, Born Again, way back in the day. It tells the story of how he found a greater calling at the lowest point of his life. A discussion of how one calls on the name of Jesus and is saved will have to wait for another day. This year I came across another one of his books, The Sky Is Not Falling. It was the second book about prisons and prisoners I'd read in as many weeks. Perhaps a prison episode is in my future. But in the context of the good future, I found The Sky Is Not Falling to be very thought-provoking. My concerns about the future of the world and the church have been well documented this month, and I've often found myself almost wallowing in cynicism. How can we evangelize a culture that already has everything it wants? How can Jesus compete for airtime with massive media conglomerates? Is there any possibility that the stranglehold currently enjoyed by humanists in spheres of power and influence could be loosened at all? Intellectually, I know positive responses to questions like these are more than reasonable. God is more powerful than all the forces of this world put together. The sword of the Spirit will puncture any heart that is open to change. But that's the problem, isn't it? The people I see on an everyday basis have no interest in changing, except insofar as to become even more worldly than they already are. Colson presents a vision of the future that is at the same time exceedingly hopeful and exceedingly uncomfortable for me. It has been his experience, he says, that people are absolutely craving the bread of life. They are as eager to seek heaven in this generation as the people in Acts 2 were. The disconnect is in the way we define people. When I think of people in terms of prospective converts to Jesus Christ, I think of the people I see every day. My neighbors, people I meet in service organizations and school groups. And I have no intention of diminishing any efforts that might be extended in those directions. But those people tend to be as contented in their lifestyle as I am in mine. A quick refusal is the norm, not the exception. Colson says discouraged would-be evangelists like me are fishing in the wrong stream. The key to making a powerful impact in the short term is going to people who are not contented, people who have reached the bottom of the barrel, like, for instance, people in prison. If you balk at the example of a Watergate criminal turned media personality, what about the example of Jesus? He was constantly seeking the company of undesirables. His critics were always amazed and somewhat disgusted at his willingness to mix and mingle with the worst of his society. The seedy underbelly, if you will, is where he found Zacchaeus and Levi and Mary Magdalene. He was drawn to the woman at the well in Samaria. And he said in no uncertain terms in Matthew 25:40 that the attitude his followers took regarding the unfortunates of the world, including prisoners, was a direct reflection of the attitude he saw them taking toward him. Now, some have suggested that the prisoners in question in this story refer specifically to those who would be imprisoned for their faith, and perhaps that's true. Even so, every soul is worth saving. And if a soul in prison might be more amenable to the gospel than the soul in front of me in the grocery store line, shouldn't that be motivation for me to cast my net on the other side? Every church would love to have 10 established upper-middle-class families call the church building asking for Bible classes this week, submit to baptism 6 weeks later, and immediately start attending regularly and writing big checks to put in the treasury. Dare to dream. But if instead the fields widen to harvest require you to get your hands scuffed up a bit in challenging and uncomfortable environments, should you and I not be willing to go there? And if not, why not? This is what I've been hearing. At long last, I get to talk about Roy Orbison. I kid you not, this song has been in my head all month. Despite what I've said already in this episode, I really am an optimistic person. I forget that sometimes when looking at the world around me and the depth of the world's depravity. I see the struggles God's people have faced in my lifetime, and it's easy to envision them being duplicated, multiplied, and exponentially broadened in my lifetime. It's depressing, frankly, and I don't like being depressed. That's where the unreservedly optimistic attitude of Shot a Roba comes in. Shot a Roba, Shot a Roba, means the future is much better than the past. half minute of research on the internet failed to show whether Shadaroba is an actual Arabic expression or whether it was songwriter Cindy Walker's invention. The future is much better than the past, Roy tells us. And he's right. Yes, perhaps it's a bit overly simplistic. And yes, the song probably has a specific reference to your love life rather than your entire life. But it is true. The future is much better than the past, if only because it hasn't happened yet. The disappointments and hardships of the past are written in stone. There's nothing you can do about that. But the future is yet unwritten. It abounds with possibilities. Nothing bad has happened in the future. So why should you behave as though you believed anything different? I found myself thinking of another song also when preparing this segment. An old Mel Brooks song from one of his movies, Hope for the Best, Expect the Worst. Maybe that would be a good counterpoint to Shadaroba. I'm not suggesting that bad things can't or won't happen. I'm not suggesting you shouldn't make provision for worst-case scenarios. But there is a world of difference between planning for bad news and assuming the bad news has already arrived. Solomon's wisdom from Ecclesiastes 5:18-20 ring as true today as ever. Here's what I have seen to be good and fitting. To eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor, in which he toils under the sun, during the few years of his life which God has given him. For this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them, and to receive his reward, and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. Life is good, Solomon says, both in the present tense and the future tense. Don't convince yourself otherwise. If Jesus had wanted us to live in dread of the future, the Spirit would not have moved Paul to tell us in Philippians 4:4, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice. And of course, this is the kicker to the whole consideration. If you persist in negativity with regard to the world's future, and again, there's plenty to be negative about, at least consider your future in Jesus. Even if every horrible prediction comes true in this life, your true eternal future lies with Jesus in heaven. Surely that should be enough to put a spring in your step and a song in your mouth on the gloomiest of days. This is what I've been playing. In Terraforming Mars, you play the part of industrialists trying to raise the ambient temperature and transform the surface conditions on Mars so humans can move in and start building farms and mines and Mexican food restaurants. Mars, as it exists now, is completely incompatible with human life. Earth, on the other hand, is perfect. We improve Mars by making it like Earth, hence the term terraforming. When I first saw the promotional material for Terraforming Mars, I was blown away. Terraforming Mars shot to the top of my watch list. In hindsight, it's easy to see I was far more impressed with the promotional material than I was with the game, which actually was not even shown, let alone described. After the game appeared on shelves and we started listening to people talk about it, we slowly came to the conclusion that Terraforming Mars was likely not the game for us, if only because it took well over 2 hours to play. A 2-hour game time is not necessarily a deal breaker in the Hammond's house, but it's pretty close. And with a relatively high price tag, a relatively complicated rules set, and relative indifference to the game from the other members of the Hammond's gaming group, it became obvious that Terraforming Mars was not for us. A couple of years ago, Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition was introduced, essentially a card game version of the regular board game. Everyone said it was virtually the same experience, just simpler and in half the time. That sounded a lot more our speed. So when we had an opportunity to get a new copy in trade, we did. Good news, Ares Expedition is an outstanding game. I see a future that includes many plays of Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition in our house, and that future is a happy one. Space exploration is an odd combination of defeatism and indefatigable confidence. We are forced to go elsewhere because we've made a mess of the world we inherited, but hey, that's okay. In the future, we'll be smart enough to create a brand new world for ourselves. And if we make as big a mess of that one as we have of this one, we'll just fire up the engines and do it all over again. We'll work it out, never you fear. It would be easy to look at this view of the world and launch into a diatribe about poor management of resources or the deification of science. But this is the good future episode, so instead I want to look at it as God's way of providing for his people. Go back to the Garden of Eden for a minute. God made a world for mankind that was absolutely perfect. We messed it up. We were deemed unworthy and forced to leave. But that didn't mean God stopped loving us or providing for us. Absolutely not. The new world was fraught with challenges and obstacles, certainly. But that was the whole point. We were to work hard to bring it under submission, according to the mandate of Genesis 1:28, all the while giving him the glory for the opportunity. In the end, of course, we were deemed unworthy even of that lesser blessing, and God destroyed our new home. Still, though, he loved and provided. The new world, it seems, was even harsher than the previous one. Still, the mandate was the same. The opportunities were the same. The challenges were the same. We show in our stewardship whether we are devoted, grateful, and diligent enough to be recipients of his grace and welcomed back into the paradise from whence we have strayed. I don't know what the future holds for the human race on planet Earth or any other planet, but I do know God has blessed us with time, strength, resources, and motivation. Our ability to use those blessings to elevate our existence is a testimony to the marvelous nature of humanity, fearfully and wonderfully made indeed, to borrow from Psalm 139:14. And no matter where the future takes us, God will be there with us, blessing us again and again. And we will do the same thing with blessings on Mars, should we receive them, as we did with blessings on Earth, or in the pre-flood Earth, or in the garden. We will show either humility or arrogance, gratitude or selfishness, wisdom or foolishness, hope or despair. Conquering that world will no doubt be even tougher than conquering the previous worlds God gave us, and we'll have no one to blame but ourselves for that. But God will be with us, and he will empower us to succeed, if we look to him as the creator and the sustainer of life, and find ways to bring him glory in our new place. In that sense, you will absolutely choose your own future, no matter what planet you spend it on. Choose wisely.